How the camera setup people set up. Okay. Starting at the top, Neil, just so you know what's going on. That one? Had it about 3 years. It helps. Okay, what we've done here is to fill you in. We're your badge.
I lost it.
Okay. We've got the European Eurovision Network filming, and some of their correspondents are back here. We've gotten together to try to let me ask some of the questions they wanted to have asked. So I'm sort of the pool center of this thing. We're taping, of course, for VOA, which incidentally is BBC Radio is carrying us worldwide. We're going worldwide, so all of us obviously are going to have a god-awful mess listening to it. Keep it clean. And then NASA headquarters is filming for headquarters to do some clips out of it. So we've doubled up about six people at once here. Okay. So thank you very much in advance. First thing I want to do is get you to say, if we're rolling tape, Doyle, just for me, clean on tape, say, I'm Neil Armstrong, spacecraft commander, Apollo 11. We just want your voice clean saying that.
I'm Neil Armstrong, commander, Apollo 11.
Okay, fine. And number two, can you give me, just in your own words, this is the sort of thing most of us will be using to open our broadcast with, a little broadcast technique stuff, a 30-second description. Is there a roach?
Spider. I don't know if he's at his LRL physical.
Okay. Think about it a sec if you want. Can you give me just about a 30-second summary of the mission and purpose of Apollo 11? Your words. You want to think about it a sec? We can do a dry run on it and then do it again. All right, Apollo 11 is, whenever you want to do it. All we want is your voice and picture saying it.
Apollo 11 is man's first attempt to demonstrate the ability to go to the moon, to land there, and to return to Earth.
15, fine, that's simple. That's guts enough. Okay. Now, want to just go through the usual thing I did with you back on 8, if I don't know, you won't remember all that. The personality, biographical stuff, I'll start it. You say Wapakoneta or Nita? Is it neither
way? But,
which way do
I
you
use,
say? Etta.
I use, yeah.
Okay. Neil Armstrong. Wapakoneta, Ohio, could be considered part of the heartland of America. You come from it, and many of the personality traits which have grown up with you are those of half the Americans walking the face of the earth today. So let's just at least briefly describe your background and what brought you into this program. When were you born?
I was born in Wapakoneta, Ohio in 1930.
And then you went to public schools there as a youngster?
Yes, I traveled around Ohio as a boy. As much as my father was an auditor for the state and traveled through a great many cities there, and I returned to Wapakoneta in high school.
Mm-hmm. Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have one sister living in a suburb of Milwaukee, Menominee Falls, and a brother living in Anderson, Indiana.
Okay, now your college education was at the same institution attended by two others of the astronaut program, Purdue University, right? What'd you major in?
Yes, I did my undergraduate work in aeronautical engineering at Purdue University. A total of four were there. Gus Grissom, Roger Chaffee, and Gene Cernan are also fellow alumni.
Were all of those associates also aeronautical engineers?
No, they weren't.
Were you any of you there at the same time?
Yes, we were all. I attended the university at the same time with one time or another with all, but only knew Gene Cernan as an undergraduate.
Your interest in flying sounds familiar to a lot of us. You first took your first airplane ride at the age of 6, is that right?
No, I think it was a good bit earlier than that. I was probably 2 or 3 at the time.
I've heard a story about you and your father sneaking off one Sunday morning when a plane came to town, and
That story's true, but I guess the age is elusive.
Okay.
Maybe I'd be giving up my real age if I told you.
Okay. But that's when flying started, is that right?
Yes, that's
And you've
first
been a
experience.
Bug about it ever since, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
When did you first get seriously interested in flying as a profession there? Was it during college, during the time of being an aeronautical engineer, or was it before that?
Well, I learned to fly in high school, and became a professional aviator as a military aviator in the U.S. Navy.
Mm-hmm. Did you have your private license at about 16 or so? The minimum
age? Yes, I had a student pilot's license at 16.
Okay. And then as a naval aviator, you flew in the Korean War, is that right?
Yes.
And then when did you enter the test pilot era of your career?
Well, I was very fortunate enough to get a position with the old NACA, National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, in 1955 as a research pilot, and really have been in that capacity ever since. Of course, NACA became the space agency, NASA, in 58, and in 1962 I transferred to the astronaut office here in Houston.
It was your experience in NACA and in this capacity which brought you in really as the first civilian astronaut, wasn't it?
Yes, actually, Elliot C., the late Elliot C., who was a engineering pilot for General Electric Company, and myself joined the astronaut program together in 1962, mm-hmm. both as civilians.
Tell me something about your experiences there with high-speed jet aircraft and that X-15 research plane.
Good fortune was upon me. I had the opportunity to work in a small but highly advanced research organization at Edwards that had the opportunity to fly a large number of advanced and quite different types of aircraft, investigating the problems of flight, and I suspect that is a position that any aviator would cherish.
Anything that particularly is exciting looking back from this day backwards, not considering some of your exciting moments with the X-15, about in other conventional jets, anything particular that stands out in your experience?
There were large number of very challenging projects there, and it was not necessarily identified with the type of aircraft that was being flown or its degree of sophistication. Some of the projects which would be as simple as evaluation of the boundary layer of the wing over an airplane at supersonic speeds in conventional jet aircraft turned out to be the most interesting and challenging from a piloting point of view.
It was a natural progression then on from high-speed developmental aircraft to spacecraft, right?
Yes, it was just more of the same kind of probing type of aeronautical research and space research that the people at NASA's Edwards Station had been doing for a number of years.
Neil, good luck on that flight, on the remainder of the flight.
Thank you very much.
This is Rhett Turner in Houston. Okay, number 2, launch preparations and liftoff. Will you just place yourself in the present tense now? This, most of us will want to use during the first few minutes, the last few minutes before liftoff. Tell me what you're doing in those final countdown moments and during the liftoff, if you will. I'll give you a starting question to it. Neil, during those last few minutes before liftoff at the Cape, you and the rest of the crew are quite busy checking the systems, last-minute things, preparatory to liftoff. Could you run down what you and the other pilots are doing?
Yes, the systems have been set up by our backup crew, the alternate crew, shortly before our entrance into the vehicle. But some of the systems must not be put into their final configuration until shortly before launch. The cabin must be purged, and the flight configuration of gases placed in the cabin after the hatch has been closed, and the flight control systems must be activated into the final launch sequence. And this is a fairly busy time for us, and we have the opportunity also to check the status of all the systems that have already been configured by the crews ahead of us.
What does a liftoff feel like? You've been into space before.
Well, it's a very pleasant but definite sensation in the Gemini spacecraft, and I'm told by the people who've flown the mighty Saturn that it's very much the same way. There's a great amount of noise, and particularly on the outside, it's noticeable. However, communications are possible in the inside the cockpit, and we are generally reporting on the events as they occur to our compatriots at the control center here in Houston. The main job of the crew in the launch period is assuring themselves and the people on the ground that everything is continuing as expected, and be prepared to discontinue the launch should any unforgivable malfunction occur.
Is it safe to say that your focus of attention is on contingencies, really, through those?
It really is completely focused on taking care of abnormalities that may occur during the launch. Now, as you know, these launches are done automatically, but in the last two spacecraft, that is Apollo 10 and Apollo 11, we have the ability to fly the booster manually with the control stick into orbit and onto the moon should a failure in the booster's launch guidance system require it.
With a good, safe launch, good luck on the rest of the mission.
Thank you very much.
All righty, that went 3 minutes. Okay, as overall spacecraft commander, just describe for me, I'll give you the go question on this. Summarize your overall role, if you can, if we can sort of synopsize your overall role as spacecraft commander. Neil, would you describe for us your overall role as spacecraft commander, as commander of this flight? How do you see your overall responsibility throughout the mission?
Well, in general, the responsibilities of the commander are to make the onboard decisions whenever they're required and to oversee the performance of the duties of all the crew, including himself. Now, in this particular case, I participate in those procedures on board the spacecraft as well as oversee those of my fellow crew members. And the specific tasks that I'm charged with the performance of include the monitoring of the launch, board procedures should they be required, manual flying of the booster should that be required, and taking my turn on watch in the normal monitoring of spacecraft systems in the command module. In the lunar module, I'm charged almost nearly equally with the lunar module pilot in the operation of the lunar module systems and control the vehicle during descent and ascent.
What is the single most important thing that you believe you have received from Apollo 10, the last flight? All of your flights lead from one to another, All of you have drawn heavily from the experience gained from other flights. Can you tell me the single thing which seems to stand out as most important that you got from Apollo 10 and its experience?
Well, the most important byproduct of Apollo 10, insofar as 11 was concerned, was the procedures which they developed to permit the lunar landing. If you remember correctly, Apollo 10 made every effort to do a full dress rehearsal of the 11 flight, and to devise their procedures in such a way that they could be used word for word, more or less verbatim, on the next flight. There were a few changes to those procedures which have come about as a result of their recommendations after having flown that flight, and some changes that have been made to our spacecraft, the Lunar Module Number 5, in the terms of its variance from Lunar Module Number 4, which was flown on Apollo 10. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Just refinement of procedures in the lunar vicinity.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much, Neil Armstrong. All right, would you start at powered descent in a present tense now, as though it's happening right now, so we can have some clear voice of you describing it. Can you just run through what you're doing? Said at PDI, such and such begins to happen, and will you trace me down to touchdown? Neil, would you describe that powered descent and touchdown as you've trained it on Earth and as you expect to carry it out on Apollo 11?
The powered descent maneuver is very much dependent on a long series of navigation and alignment procedures prior to its actual initiation. The actual descent starts on the back side of the moon about an hour before descent. As we approach the descent orbit insertion maneuver an hour prior to descent, our concern is with making that maneuver to the greatest extent possible perfect. And what is meant by perfect at this time is to change our orbit such that it will become an orbit of 50,000 foot altitude precisely at the point where the descent maneuver is taking place about 250 miles upstream of the landing point. As we descend toward the lunar surface after DOI, we will of course be coming down. We are coming down from about 60 nautical miles at the start to about 10 or 9 nautical miles height at the ignition of the engine. During that time period where we are checking our alignment by viewing the sun's position with respect to our spacecraft and by determining our altitude above the lunar surface by time measurements of the rate of passage of landmarks underneath ourselves. As we approach ignition, we use our radar to check our relative velocity to the command module, assuring ourselves that we are the proper distance below his orbit. At ignition, we're interested in finding out where over the surface of the moon we are. Are we, in fact, at the precise geometric location that we expected to start the maneuver? We do this by looking at the surface of the moon and placing ourselves with respect to craters on the lunar surface. After ignition, we are verifying that the trajectory, its velocity, its altitude, and its cross-range position are matching the pre-flight predicted values. After about 3 minutes and 39 seconds, we check the crater Maskelyne W and make sure that we are proceeding at that point in time on the trajectory we expect with respect to the moon. At that point, at an altitude of 40,000 feet, we'll roll over and lock the radar on the surface, acquire our altitude above the surface and know that we are in fact a proper distance above the moon, continue descent down to approximately 8,000 feet, or we'll pitch over to our first view of the landing site.
How close to the surface can you burn the descent engine when you get down and those probes start to touch?
We will continue burning the engine until an altitude of only about 5 feet, at which the probes will ignite the a light on our panel. We see it illuminate, we cut the engine, and fall the last several feet to touchdown.
How near the surface can you get for stage and abort that emergency engine?
If the descent engine should stop running and we require ourselves to abort and stage, we will need to have approximately 100 feet altitude to give us sufficient time to ignite the SN engine before touching the lunar surface.
Thanks very much for describing that, Neil. John, weren't we late getting started? Because I swear I still had...
I'll give you one question. You might have been a minute late, Fred.
Well, I really had two or three things to...
The question is for us not to start you up, but I started counting at about 16 after. If you want to ask one question...
Well, it's just, there were a couple of quickies here.
Why don't you make it one quickie?
Okay. It's the old Columbus question, and I'm sure you've had it. So if you can, reflect a little bit on your position to that of Columbus and all this stuff. I'll try to give you a starter, and whatever you feel like saying on it, fine. If you don't, tell me no. Fine. Neil Armstrong, this mission, the accomplishment that you expect to achieve, is often compared to that of Columbus discovering one new world. You may be the first man to discover another. How do you feel about such comparisons of adventurers of the past and the historical importance of your mission, the role you will play?
Well, I'm very impressed to be compared with Columbus, and of course we recognize his discovery and have honored it in some respects by the call sign of our command module, Columbia. There are some favorable comparisons and some that won't hold true. Certainly, Columbus's venture was one that was very expensive in his time. It was one that very few countries could afford, and Spain could afford only by digging into the very depths of their treasury. It was a voyage with a good bit of risk and some complaints. However, in many ways, it was not at all like the voyage of Apollo 11. First, he wasn't sure where he was going. At least he thought he was going to China or the Indies, and ended up, of course, in a completely new world. Now, I very much hope that we won't terminate at some place that we didn't expect to, some planet that we hadn't planned to visit. I think we know a good bit about the place that we are going, and it's also necessary to notice that he did it without an entire nation's efforts behind him. Our voyage is the voyage of a nation and the voyage of humanity, while his was a voyage of a very limited few.
Thanks very much, Neil. Good luck.
Yeah, Rhett, you read me? You're the guy who told me not to bug you when you started, but we're